Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast. We're adding a new addition to this podcast, a weekly in-depth discussion of one of the pieces in the magazine. And I'm delighted to be launching it today with a discussion about Libya with the politician and writer Kwasi Kwarteng and the journalist Kim Sengupta. In this week's issue of the magazine, the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson writes about his recent trip to Libya. He says that we have to deal with the economic roots of the migration crisis, and that means dealing with the crisis in Libya. So, Kwasi, why is Libya so important right now?
I think Libya's importance in terms of European politics, if not global politics, is that it's very much the gateway for a lot of immigration, or rather migration, from sub-Saharan Africa into Europe. Something like 200 to 500 people a day are paying vast amounts of money. Boris says 1,500 euros, I've heard $1,000. But in that order, each individual is paying this in order to be shipped essentially from Libya, from Africa, the continent of Africa, into Europe. And I think as the summer months start, as we get into the summer, this crisis, this flow of people will increase. And it represents probably the biggest migration, in terms of migration, into Europe for a very long time. And clearly it's straining European politics, not only politics, but the infrastructure of countries like Italy to deal with this influx. And the last thing I'll say about this is that one of the big problems is that it's a humanitarian tragedy. There's also a sense in which, you know, hundreds of people are losing their lives needlessly in the Mediterranean as a consequence of this huge traffic of people.
Kim, why is it that Libya has become such a hub for trafficking?
Well, it always was. And I remember in the days following the fall of Tripoli, when we were there and Gaddafi had fled, and of course he was then caught and murdered later on. But you know, at the time, I remember we met traffickers who told us that, you know, they were on instructions from the Gaddafi regime not to allow migrants to go over. So basically they were ordered to stop their trade, and that was partly because in return Gaddafi got a huge subsidy from the EU. And this was part of the deal when you know, Gaddafi had given up his WMD arsenal and you know, the Lockerbie trial and everything else. And part of the deal was that, you know, he will stop the migrant route coming from sub-Saharan Africa through Libya. And of course that has now fallen apart, and there's an awful lot of money to be made from that. You know, I've spoken to, as have my colleagues, to traffickers in two or three ports in Libya, and the amounts that can be made are huge. So the financial incentive is pretty good for them.
Sure.
Kwasi, who are the key players right now in Libya?
So, I mean, my own perception, I travelled to Libya, I've been travelled extensively in the east of the country, which I need to say is much more stable. So a lot of the trafficking, a lot of the people smuggling, if you like, takes place in the west, in places around Misrata and further west. And the east is stable, is fairly well controlled, and there's very little migration coming from that region. Now, if you speak to people in the Foreign Office, if you speak to they'll say, well, of course, that's a geographical function of the fact that the geography, the ports in the west and nearer Europe. But I don't really buy that. I think that the reason why migrants aren't coming from the east is because there's more political stability there. The west is run essentially by a number of militias. There are people like Belhaj, Suhaili, other people who are militia sort of warlords. And they, as we've said, are making a lot of money out of it. Each individual has to pay, as I said, between $1,000 or $1,500 per person. So you can see there's a big profit that people can make from trafficking hundreds of thousands of people. So the West is in, I think, a state of flux. There's no real political authority there, and people are exploiting that vacuum and making a lot of money through this inhuman traffic in people.
And earlier this year, you were in Libya and you met General Haftar. Is that?
Yeah, I met Field. He's now a Field Marshal. He was promoted, I think, last year by the House of Representatives in Tobruk. And his view was very much that, he's a military man. He's someone who's very much an operational soldier. And he feels that we need to have a stable, unified government in Libya. And the issue is that many people feel he's going to be another Gaddafi. So there has to be a political settlement in which he's involved. I noticed in Boris's article that he mentions the fact that Haftar has to be part of the peace, but we don't want to be in a situation where we simply create another Gaddafi. But as was said, Gaddafi did actually contain this problem because he had a strong unified government and he was subsidised to a large extent by the EU.
Kim, what role is Britain playing in all of this?
Well, I can perhaps if we can go back slightly. I mean, we do recall the role that Britain and France played when the revolution first started in 2011, when, if you recall, the cry was Gaddafi must go, and the cry mainly came from David Cameron and Nicolas Sarkozy. And I remember being in Benghazi when the Gaddafi forces were on the outskirts of Benghazi and there were talk of great massacres to come, and next morning there were the airstrikes by France and Britain outside the fields of outside Benghazi in the fields, and you know it looked a bit like the what happened to Saddam's army when they were retreating from Basra. You know, they were caught in the open ground and destroyed. So that was the beginning of the involvement of Britain and France, and you know we know what happened. So what's happening now in Libya is intrinsically linked to the roles played by the UK and France at the time. And so one would think that if there is such a thing, a moral duty for the UK to try and put back together, you know, what has fallen apart in Libya. Now, from a last visit, which was to Tripoli and Misrata and Sirte, which was a long time ago, which was 4 or 5 months ago, it seems it's the Italians who are doing most of the running now, certainly in the Tripoli sector. And the Italians have been asking the UK to open up an embassy in Tripoli, which the UK is not prepared to do yet. I remember when Dominic Asquith was the ambassador there, you know, the very good ambassador now in India, And Dominic almost got killed outside Benghazi when his convoy was ambushed. So there is a bit of resistance on the part of London to start opening a legation now in Tripoli. But I think that has to be done. And I think the UN forces, you know, there are special forces already there, Italian, German and British and American, of course. And, you know, they've got to be backed up. And Sarraj's government has got to be buttressed and allowed to take over the whole of Tripoli, which they haven't done yet. I feel slightly sorry for a friend of mine, Mashal Azuez, who is the oil minister in the Islamist government. He used to be my driver and translator during the revolution. Now he's a minister, but hopefully he will find a place in the coalition government. But the main thing, it seems to me, is to stabilise the Sarraj government, give it the military backing it lacks. And whatever one thinks of General Haftar, he's there to stay, and you can't ignore him. And they've just now made him the head of the army, Field Marshal Haftar. He's been courted by the Russians. He's in obviously very ill in with the Egyptians, so he's a factor. And, you know, he's quite a main factor. But then, you know, even if we go through all that, the fact remains there are other militias in Misrata, in Zintan, and then you have got the Tuaregs in the south who all need to be brought into the fold somehow. And that's going to take a long time, a lot of effort, and the UK should certainly, considering the role the UK had in the revolution, should certainly be playing a part.
I think what Kim says goes to the heart of this problem, because Italians I speak to very much feel that we are in some way, as British politicians, British government, in some way implicated in what went wrong, in that we intervened, we helped to get rid of Gaddafi, but we didn't really follow through in terms of the backup. That's what they think. And so they feel that we sort of barged in, broke the country up, and then haven't really taken our responsibility in putting it together again. We, on the other hand, I think, rightly in a way, feel that, yes, we intervened on a humanitarian basis, but once the intervention had happened, it was very much up to the Libyan people to decide what the future was. And so between these different views, there is a tension. I happen to agree with Kim that we probably should get more involved. But at the same time, we can't impose a settlement. You know, there has to be an agreement between the various players. I happen to think Sarraj is a lot weaker and a lot less credible than perhaps Kim does. I don't see a world in which Sarraj can be the head of the whole country, the united country. I think he's too compromised and too weak. And I also feel, as Kim suggested, that Haftar is going to be, Field Marshal Haftar is going to be part of the eventual solution. I don't think he should necessarily be a president or a dictator or anything like that. I don't think we need to do that. But he has to be involved in reaching a solution.
Do you think at this point what places like Libya need are kind of strongman figures? Do you think that we're kind of entering that era?
I'll put it in a different way. I think that the idea that these countries after the Arab Spring were going to become havens of democracy and pluralism, I think was one of the biggest mistakes that we've conducted in modern international politics. I also think it was terribly naive, and we don't understand. People who think that, I don't think understand enough about the history and the cultural context of large parts of the Middle East to expect that Egypt is going to operate a multi-party parliamentary system in the way that Australia does, I think is naive and unrealistic. It may do in 5, 10, 20 years, but that's a process. That's something we need. It's a progression. It's a development. It's not something that could be immediately imposed from a Western capital like London or Paris or Washington. And I think it's naive to think that it'll spring up spontaneously without a good deal of preparation.
Well, first of all, I agree entirely. I don't think Sarraj is a particularly strong character. I don't think he has got enough backing, which is the reason to give him that backing, because he is all we've got.
But you can't prop up something that's inherently weak.
We can prop it up to a point, you know, until...
If something is decrepit...
You can wait forever for someone to come along whose idea...
No, but there are people. There are. Anyway,
But the notion that
someone is weak, therefore we should prop him up, is not sustainable.
Everyone is weak. Apart from Haftar, who has got the army behind him. But then again, we do not want another military dictator.
No, but there's a halfway between saying that...
Which is
Sarraj,
the reason he has been made the head of the army.
Yeah, but I'm afraid... You see, this is where I disagree with Kim, because we've got to deal with realities on the ground. It's all very well to say, you know, such and such a leader is great, but he has he can't even control a hotel. He was booted out of the hotel in Libya at the end of 2016. He can barely control Tripoli, and he basically, Sarraj in this instance, is reliant on militias to control the capital, albeit a big capital. And he has no traction wider than Tripoli.
Sure, but the thing is, you know...
So the idea that the Western powers are going to suddenly make him this strong, unified leader, I think is very naive and mistaken.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that certainly in my experience, which is not a huge one, I've been to Libya about 18, 19 times now, there isn't anyone who immediately springs up. When I speak to my friends in the Misrata militia, and a bit in the Zintanis as well, they may be able to work with Sarraj. Now, Sarraj is certainly, I agree with you, not ideal, but then, you know, who is there? Now, you've got a strange situation, of course, in Zintan, when Saif al-Gaddafi, Gaddafistan is now missing. No one knows where he is. There's all kinds of, you know, imponderable factors. And at the moment, Sarraj isn't ideal. But then again, you know, he has been chosen for the time being by the West, and he is all we have got. Now, the fact is that he's a figurehead. But then again, you know, maybe that's what one needs for the time being. And it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy at all. And you know, I mean, you're forgetting the Tuareg militia in the south. You know, I spent a lot of time in Mali and the arms coming from Libya into Mali, going into the Hainaut, in the hands of Al-Qaeda down there in the Maghreb. So you know, it's an almighty mess. But, you know, we probably wouldn't start from here, but this is where we are. So if you can think of anyone better than...
Well, I think Haftar has got a much more... I mean, I've met the field marshal. He controls essentially the whole of the East, and he's controlling most of the oil fields. Not all of them, but most of them. And actually, I mean, it sounds like a terribly cynical note, but the reason why Sarraj is there isn't because he's strong, it's because he's weak. There are a lot of people in the West who are making huge amounts of money through trafficking. There are slave markets, if you can believe that, in the West of Libya. And a lot of people are making money out of the anarchy. And forgive me if I'm being cynical, but a lot of people, I think, believe that Sarraj is there precisely because he's weak, and people can continue making the money that they're doing. They don't want a strong leader. They don't want to have to be in legitimate business and pay taxes. And they are benefiting from the chaos in a very material financial way. Now, there are rumours, they may not be true, but there are rumours that all sorts of people are engaged in this trafficking. I've heard Sicilian mafia, I've heard Russian mafia, I've heard all sorts of criminal elements in Europe are benefiting very strongly, very materially on a financial basis, doing this trafficking. And to pretend, I think, or to continue this sort of balletic dance in which Siraj is the answer. I don't think we're going to get anywhere. I think we'll be debating this in 3 years and there'll be hundreds of thousands of more migrants who've come to Italy and Europe.
Well, we may well be debating in 3 years unless we are bored with Libya by then, which is what's happened, of course, in the past. We get bored and the situation festers, get worse, and then we go back to it. And
I
then
can
we
well
get,
see that.
Get bored again, this endless cycle of negligence followed by sudden flurry of interest, and then it gets worse and worse and worse. But Siraj is almost too weak to be this kind of, in my view, this kind of underworld corruption chief.
No, that's not my point. Sorry, I'm making a different point from that. I'm not saying that he is directly responsible.
But he's saying he's not stopping it.
I'm saying he's the front man who allows, through his negligence and weakness.
I think it's weakness rather than...
I don't think he's I don't think he's a criminal mastermind in the way that Blofeld or some great sort of James Bond villain is. He's not that at all. I think he's a decent man. But I think his weakness allows other people who are more wicked and more nefarious to exploit the vacuum and make a great deal of money in trafficking people.
That pattern is followed, elsewhere. I'm going to Iran at the weekend for the elections, and half the people there are, engaged in all kinds of nefarious activities.
But that doesn't make it good.
It's a fact of life. This is not Scandinavia.
I know it isn't.
The fact of
but
life.
But we thought
and
it would
you've
be.
Got to, no, I, mean, I don't think anyone thinks Scandinavia.
An element of people, certainly if I roll the clock back to 2011, a lot of people honestly believed that we could have functioning democracies, pluralistic democracies in large parts of the Middle East. Well, and the last 5 years has totally exploded that idea.
Well, that may well have been the case in London, I don't know, but it's having spent most of that time on the ground in Libya, Tunisia, where it started, of course, and Tunisia has reached a modicum of stability and probably will be all right. But it's Libya should be all right. I mentioned Iran, but Libya is one of the few countries there which is not suffering from the Sunni-Shia schism.
That's right.
I mean, Libya is 6 million. They're all Sunnis, not just Sunnis. They're all Malkis. So, that sectarian factor, thankfully, is not present there, unlike Yemen, Bahrain, you name it. So there should be, and they've got oil. So, there should be, a stable government and a rich country. And one of the reasons it's not is because of the way, the West managed to mess it up. Having been in Benghazi and Ashdabaya and Ras Al-Nuf when Gaddafi forces came in, they did some terrible things. But, it is a typical Western response to go and carry out regime change and then put nothing in its place.
Kim, you've also said that Libya, not Syria, will be the foundation on which Trump and Putin will build their new world order. What do you mean by that?
Well, that came from people I spoke to at a NATO conference, which was General Mattis's first. And they're talking about, because the Russians are, they too are sponsoring Haftar, to an extent. And I've spoken to people in the DOD who are thinking in terms of, backing Haftar in some way. They are certainly not averse to that. Certainly that was, when I wrote it, that was the case. But having said that, the dynamics are shifting a bit because General Sisi, President Sisi, one of the main sponsors of Haftar, and he had met Siraj and others, and the UAE, which was a big, big supporter of Haftar. Egyptians and Emirati planes carried out airstrikes on behalf of Haftar. They too have met Siraj and the UN-backed government. So dynamics are changing, a bit on the ground. But I think I personally see nothing hugely wrong with the Americans and Russians working together in Libya. I wouldn't have thought the Russians are back in the Middle East in a very big way now, as you know. But I don't think they'll particularly want to extend their lines to Libya. It'll be a bit of an overstretch. And, going back to how we started, I certainly believe the general, the field marshal, Haftar has got a big role to play. But I'd rather not see him as a military protector of a shogun of Libya.
So this is where we are, really, in this debate. I think most people agree that simply because in terms of the boots on the ground, the Libyan National Army, the fact that the House of Representatives in Tobruk, the East, is largely behind the field marshal. Everyone, pretty much, that I speak to on this issue suggests that he will play a big role in the future, in the immediate future of Libya. Now, the question is, what sort of role? Obviously, we don't want to have, many people don't want to go back to a kind of military dictatorship. They don't want to see a kind of, as you say, a strong man, or as Kim says, a shogun running the country. They want to have more kind of pluralistic structures. But the debate doesn't seem to me a qualitative one. I think it's in terms of the quantity of power, if you like, the authority that Haftar has. There's no doubt, there's no solution without him, as long as he's a player. And so people feel that that Haftar will be involved. My only problem is that, my big question mark, is that I think there are powerful interests who are concerned to keep the status quo. Because as Western diplomats and politicians, we always assume that people want to reach a solution. But as I've travelled in the Middle East, you know, as an MP, I've found that many people in the Middle East are quite happy to live with a modicum of chaos. They're quite happy to live with a modicum. They don't see the world in the clean edges that we do in Whitehall and London and elsewhere. And I think a lot of people actually can live with this degree of chaos, and they're making good money trafficking people. And, you know, it's a revenue stream that they don't want to see end too quickly.
Just finally, from both of your experience in Libya, do you think people there think life was better before or after Gaddafi was deposed?
I just think you look at the numbers. I mean, just as a matter of fact, and you can check this up on the website or the CIA information fact book, the GDP per head, I think, has gone down 40% in the last 6 years. And the country is a lot less stable. It's not as unified. And I think many people, I'd probably say the majority, although it's difficult to measure these things, would suggest that life was better under Gaddafi for all the monstrosities and tyranny that he represented.
Well, it's a difficult one for me because, on one hand, you've got the people that we as journalists tend to meet tend to have a stake in the fight. So when you've got the ideologues, you've got people who have lost their families to the Gaddafi regime. You know, they are, of course, implacable in their hatred of Gaddafi and what he stood for. But I agree, because on the vast majority
of the
man in the street, you know, they want that stability. You know, they want the lack of authority to go. I mean, there are, for example, things which doesn't really affect us as foreigners. The huge number of kidnappings, for example, that takes place for criminal rather than political purposes. And a lot of people I know, my friends, you know, have suffered from that. So yes, you know, they, like people everywhere really, you know, they crave stability. But I'm not sure that they really agree on the best way forward. And that therein lies the problem.
That was Kwasi Kwarteng and Kim Sengupta. And just a reminder also that we've got a special subscription offer for the election. You can get 6 issues of The Spectator for just £6, which includes full access to the website at spectator.co.uk/election offer.